is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast NBA Preview Extravaganza. We've teamed up with podcasters from every NBA city to do a deep dive into each team, recapping last season, discussing their key off-season roster moves, the most intriguing storylines, best-case, worst-case scenarios. Plus, each of our guests weigh in with a prediction for their team's regular season record and how far they'll advance in the playoffs, or not, next spring.
We think you'll love hearing from these experts around the league about the teams they cover day in and day out. We'll put out 6 episodes broken down by division over the course of 6 days from October 14th through the 19th, leading up to opening night on October 22nd.
Jason and I will weigh in with our own thoughts on the coming season on the final episode of the Hoopheads Pod Preview Extravaganza that will drop on Monday, October 21st. We know you're going to love hearing from this great lineup of podcasters from around the NBA. This episode covers the NBA's Central Division, the Bulls, Cavs, Pistons, Pacers, and Bucks.
Hey Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist Jefferson Mason and marketing manager Nick Bartlett on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads Podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
The Chicago Bulls with Joe Cowley from the Chicago Sun-Times. All right, we're welcoming to the podcast tonight Joe Cowley from the Chicago Sun-Times to talk some Chicago Bulls basketball. Joe, let's look back at season the Bulls had last year, and then we'll look ahead to what they've done in the offseason to change up their roster and get ready for 2020.
Yeah, I mean, you know, last year, obviously, it was all about injuries and disappointment and kind of underachieving. At the same time, some flashes of brilliance. You know, Lauri Markkanen's February was ridiculous. It was elite. It was something that they got excited about. You know, anytime you change a coach, especially in the NBA and midstream, it's tough. And Jim Boylan went through that. There was obviously the initial pushback by a couple players. You know, Jabari Parker was a problem. So there was a lot of obstacles that they had to overcome. And, you know, all the talk this offseason was not only about changing the culture and building a different culture with the Bulls, but more importantly, Jim Boylan having a full training camp to kind of re-inject that culture that he jump-started last year, and adding guys that will help even translate to the younger players more. You know, last year they traded for Otto Porter, and I think he was kind of that coach whisperer and that go-between guy between the locker room and Boylan. And then this offseason they've added even more guys to do that. So, you know, there's a lot of excitement in that locker room and hope, but there's also the reality that this is still a rebuild. This is still year 3 of the rebuild. So, you know, that's why I think best case scenario, they're hoping and feeling that they can maybe be in that anywhere in that 8-10, maybe 11 spot in the East if all goes pretty well.
So they added Satoransky and Thaddeus Young, probably the two biggest additions along with you know, drafting Coby White. So talk a little bit about those guys and how you think they fit in to what the Bulls' plans are for this year.
Well, I mean, Thaddeus Young is a dog. I mean, that's the best way to sum him up. He's a no-nonsense vet who doesn't care what his role is, how many minutes he gets, what he's asked to do, where he has to play. And that's what Jim Boylan wants. He wants guys that when they interviewed him for free agency, they didn't ask, well, how much am I a starter or how many minutes can you give me? They just said, let's go. And so, you know, that's the kind of guy that Boylan wants. And he knows him from coaching in Indiana and keeping in conversation with the Indiana guys. And Thaddeus Young told us over the summer that every time they would play the Bulls, Boylan would come up to him and say, you know, how you doing? You look great. And this is what's going on with my team. So they've always kind of been talking and kept that friendly relationship intact. So, you know, I mean, he's brought in to do what Thaddeus Young does, which is kind of be the watchdog of that locker room and also give them quality minutes at the four. Maybe he'll allow Lauri Markkanen to scoot over to the five late in games. That was a lineup they looked at last year, late in games, and had some success with before the injuries hit. So I think they'd like that again just because that would give them more multi-ball handlers, and that's the way they like to attack teams now with those multi-ball handlers, you know, get a rebound and go. And we saw that from Lauri Markkanen a lot last year. So, and then Satoransky, I mean, look, this is one of those guys that you know, he sneaks up on you, and you talk to executives around the league, and they're like, you know, that was just a perfectly well-orchestrated, sneaky pickup because – everyone knew Washington was kind of in trouble financially still. I mean, getting rid of Otto Porter was nice, but there's still money that they had to shed. And then for the Bulls to sign and do a sign and trade and acquire him and then watch what he does in FIBA and the World Cup for the Czech Republic, I mean, he was phenomenal as a point guard. So the hope for them is for him to come in and win that starting point guard spot, which, you know, if they can't move Chris Dunn by then or move him by the end of camp, you know, the hope is, okay, well, now Chris Dunn, you have to compete. You can't have something handed to you. So, you know, that could be kind of a double bonus for them. And you know, the nice thing about Satoransky is he's not your typical Euro. He plays with an edge. But at the same time, he can play off the ball, which would be huge for them. You know, Zach LaVine, they like to have the ball in his hands late in games. And so, you know, Satoransky could actually hit corner threes where Chris Dunn, I mean, you didn't even have to guard him. you know, so that's the look they're giving. And then White is a, you know, kind of that speed demon, push the ball. You know, they drafted him and they called him a point guard. And we've talked about this before. He's not a point guard yet. I don't know if he'll develop into a point guard or how quickly that will come. To me, he's a two guard right now and kind of backing up Zach LaVine and they'll slowly let him run some some point guard and let him kind of find his way. But there's not a lot of pressure for him to come in and say, okay, I'm the point guard now that they got Satoransky. So, you know, that's where they stand with the new faces.
What's the number one storyline in your mind heading into this season?
Oh, man, I would have to say that they, you know, all eyes are kind of on Jim Boylan. You know, this is a guy that kind of was a bull in a China shop last year. I mean, he came in and he was knocking dishes down and was telling people, you know, the way things need to be and the way they should be. And, you know, he eased up as the year went on. And I think some guys actually embraced him and embraced that style of coaching. I mean, you saw at the end of the year, Zach LaVine actually offered to pay a fine that Boylan got for arguing, you know, his case and on the court incident. So, you know, I think all things will kind of center around Boylan and, you know, is this guy the right guy that they extended for 3 years? I mean, is he basically a football coach that's coaching the NBA? And, you know, I mean, because that's kind of how he comes across sometimes, just with that gruff exterior. And, you know, you could see him just on a Sunday sideline, you know, bitching at linebackers. That's just how he comes across. So to me, that's having his first camp with his new assistants and this new look team, how he meshes with these guys and how they kind of vibe off of him, to me is the big storyline. So
what's the best case, worst case scenario for how this season could turn out for the Bulls?
I mean, I think best case they sneak into that eight spot and they're probably out by the first round. You know, everyone rips on the East, but when you look around, I mean, you're still talking about, you know, some talented teams that have a lot more going for them than the Bulls. And so, you know, the Bulls on paper, you say, okay, well, this is the year that, you know, this is year three for Lauri Markkanen. That's supposed to be a telltale huge year for a guy. And Zach LaVine, another year for him to do something spectacular. And, you know, the All-Star game is coming to Chicago, and I know he wants to play in it. And I wouldn't be surprised if he actually goes back in the dunk contest for it as well. So he wouldn't tip his cards that way, but that's the way he sounded to me at the end of the year. So, you know, the best case is they do sneak into that last playoff spot. I mean, worst case is, look, the injuries continue. I mean, this is a team that can't stay healthy. You know, they don't have Tom Thibodeau to blame anymore. I mean, this was, you know, 4 years of or three plus years of Fred Hoiberg coach teams also having injury problems. And then, you know, when Boylan took over, they had injury problems. So this is a bunch of guys that can't stay healthy. And, you know, there's a lot of abilities to have, but availability in the NBA is the most important. And the Bulls have not had that.
So in your mind, if you look at those two scenarios, what do you see as being the most likely outcome? What do you see next April when the regular season ends up? Where do you see them record-wise finishing? Where do you see them finishing in the East, in your opinion?
Yeah, I still see them probably in that 9-10 spot. I don't think they're a playoff team yet. Even if they stay, you know, you're going to have to count on a couple injuries. That's just life. And every NBA team kind of expects that. So you kind of just have to embrace that as the new way of the NBA. There aren't guys that are playing 82 games anymore. It just doesn't happen. They have the depth now where they can handle that, and they also have interchangeable parts where they can handle that, where you're not bringing in totally different guys. I mean, look, Robin Lopez was a totally different guy than Wendell Carter Jr. and played differently, and they had to do different things when those guys were on the floor, where this year they've tried to add guys that are interchangeable so they could keep the same system and run the same system. So that I think will help them and be a bonus and get them – you know, 5, 6, 7 more wins. But still, I mean, to jump up in the East and be a playoff team, I mean, say you got to win 40, 41, 42. I mean, that you're talking about a 12, 13 game improvement. That's not easy to do, even if, you know, you're coming back with a healthier roster and a new look roster. So I see them in that 9-10 spot.
What's your take on Markkanen's ceiling at this point? Where do you think, if you project his career out another 5 years, where do you see him getting to in his career?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is you see him do what he did in February and you're like, all right, you can go ahead and put this dude in the unicorn category. I mean, cause that's what he is. I mean, he's that 7-footer that can, you know, pick and pop, can pick and roll, mid-range game, rebounds, runs the floor, handles. I mean, you check all the boxes and say, yeah, he's a unicorn. But it's just the frequency of the injuries and the missing games, and you know, that's a concern. Is he tough enough to make that next jump? Does he know the difference between injury and pain? And are these going to be things that continue to linger with him? And you know, we're going to see a buffed up version of Markkanen. You know, from the people I've talked to and from the pictures they've shown of his workouts. He's buffed. So, you know, he went through this last year and came in and, you know, had 16 pounds of muscle. And then what happens? He gets injured in training camp and, injures the elbow really badly and can't lift and loses all that muscle. And by the time he comes back, he looked like, you know, the rookie version of Markkanen. And so, they put that weight back on him. It's all supposed to be good weight to give him a little more presence in the post. So, I mean, if that holds up, if he could hold up and show that he's no longer a boy, he's a man, and can get through this year three, which, you know, again, to me is one of the more important ones in the NBA, where you see if a guy finally either gets it or is always going to kind of have his inconsistencies. Yeah, I mean, then the team is built around him. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, they had money for a max guy or a guy close to a max guy this offseason, and they assessed and looked at the roster and said, you know what? We believe Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen have a all-star stardom ceiling. And so that's the branch that they've climbed out on, and that's the limb that they're either going to, you know, die on or that they build off of. So, you know, all eyes will be on those two as well because, you know, they added pieces around those two to elevate those two. They didn't add another star to help those guys. They added pieces that are going to help elevate those two guys. And so this is huge for Lauri. He really has to take a step in consistency this year.
How does the fan base feel about this team?
I mean, this Bulls team is probably, I'd say right now they're one of the more hated teams by the fan base. And that's not based on the players. I think there's just such a disdain for the general manager, Gar Forman, and the front office and, you know, the same old status quo of this front office being intact for so long and having failure, but still getting chances that most organizations would never give a front office. So, it's been an angry fan base as far as the Bulls for a while. So it'll be interesting to see if they play well, if that turns around and if that gets better. It's been an angry fan base for a couple of years right now.
Well, based on what they did in the offseason and the hopeful growth of their young players, I think there's at least the case can be made that they're on an upward trajectory. Now, where that trajectory ultimately puts them at the end of this rebuild, I'm not sure. But I think there's definitely something here where they put together kind of an interesting roster by adding the guys that they added in the offseason and then with the young guys that they have coming back. So, Joe, thanks a lot for coming on with us today and talking Chicago Bulls. We appreciate it, and we will catch up with you soon.
Anytime, boys.
The Cleveland Cavaliers with Dan Menigan from 92.3 The Fan.
Hi, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Hoopheads podcast. We're going to talk with Dan Menigan. We're going to talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers and their upcoming season. Dan Menigan works for 92.3 The Fan. Dan, thanks for joining.
No worries, brother. How you been?
I'm doing well. We'll talk a little bit about the Cavs here. We'll see how well we are feeling at the end of this podcast. So, Dan, why don't you briefly, and you might be able to summarize it in one word, briefly discuss the Cavs season last year.
So Kevin Love got hurt and everything went into the toilet. I mean, that's kind of the best way to describe it. And that, frankly, that was the goal, whether they want to admit it or not, because the draft pick, their number one overall draft pick, was owed to Atlanta if it fell outside of the top 10. So as my buddy Jake Chapman put it, because he put it better than anybody I've heard yet, play well, but take the L. And that was the goal of the entire season, was play well, but take the L. And so did they lose more games than a lot of people thought they would? Yeah. Was it a bad thing? No, because Colin Sexton got a boltload of playing time, as he was supposed to, and you played all the kids in between there and figured out who could sink in the pool and who can float. And the guys who can float are the ones that you know you can build around, and the ones who can sink found themselves elsewhere. And so Rodney Hood and Kyle Korver and all the veterans got expedited at the trade deadline, as they should, for various draft picks. And now they are essentially and this brings us to this year, they essentially became a dumping ground for draft picks and bad contracts. And so now we roll into this year with young kids, draft picks, and bad contracts.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the big thing was we were, Mike and I were talking how we wanted to tank for Zion all season. Like, literally, game one happened, they lost badly, and we were like, all right, guys, good job. Keep it up.
Now, obviously, yeah, we didn't stop trying for Zion, man. We were in the same camp.
Yeah, so, I know it didn't end up with Zion, but I think what's important to note here is I think the big thing, in my opinion, is we're gonna talk about this season in a second, but I think the future for the Cavs is bright in the sense that we don't have a lot of contracts on the books after this year. So I think there's a lot of good things that are going to happen once that happens, in the sense that we can make some moves if we really can somehow attract people. Now, that's another conversation all in itself, but I think they're kind of going to kind of rebuild. I'm hoping they're going to go the Sacramento Kings / Portland Trailblazers route of kind of building from within and going that route. Like, and then when they get the chance to move into the big free agency mark, they can do that. But I guess we'll have to see how this season plays out.
Well, the interesting thing is you can't really talk about the Cavs unless you all of a sudden have a doctorate in capology in the NBA, because that's really where they sit. They're in this weird spot where now they have all of these expiring contracts all over the place. I mean, Matthew Dellavedova, I believe, I'm doing this off the top of my head, so my numbers may not be specific, but I believe he's close to $15 to $16 million falling off the books. Now, that doesn't have the same impact that it did 5 years ago, but that's still some level of impact that a team can bring in a guy like Dellavedova, toss the Cavs some assets, which is really what they're looking for, whether that's a first-round pick or a second-round pick, and then all of a sudden end up with this guy who falls off the books at the end of the year and helps clean some stuff up.
Yeah, and I think Tristan's kind of in the same boat. I mean, I don't know that anyone's going to really say, oh, Tristan Thompson's going to put us over the edge for the playoffs, but, you know, you might get some sucker at the trade deadline who's like, hey, we need this guy. He's going to get lots of rebounds and play defense for us, and he comes off the books too this year. So I think, you know, you're right. I think the Cavs definitely are in a good position as far as contract situation. So what do you think about the acquisitions? What do you think about, I guess, really the only acquisitions the Cavs have this offseason were the draft picks. So what do you think about the way they went about the draft this year?
Well, the problem is, and I don't know if a problem is really the best way to put it, but it's just the truth of the matter, which is you bought a title in 2016 and you attempted to buy a title in 2017. And now all of a sudden the bill is due and you're sitting here paying off the contracts of Tristan Thompson and J.R. Smith, who fell off the books finally. And even that one was a $5 million buyout more than anything else. So he's still not totally off the books. And, you know, all the other contracts that were thrown out, the George Hill deal, Lord knows how many others are sitting there. And so now all of a sudden you're stuck with these other bad contracts that they were flipped for. And it's going to be really, really interesting to see what takes place this season, because there were no offseason moves to improve this team. It was just the draft picks. It was Garland. It was Michael Porter Jr. It was
Windler.
I was going to say Dylan, and then I was piecing it together in my head. It's going to be those kids from there to find out the same thing that we were trying to figure out last year, which is who can sink and who can float. And I'm really interested to see what that looks like with these guys mixed with John Beilein and Lindsey Gottlieb and J.B. Bickerstaff and all the other things that are taking place inside of this building that maybe the casual basketball fan is looking at and yawning, but the basketball nerd is looking at going like, wait a minute, there's something weird taking place in this building that's not normal. Yeah. And I want to see what this turns into.
Yeah, I think that's the other – I guess that's the key acquisition there, the coaching staff. I think it's going to be interesting to see how Beilein goes about doing this. Now, obviously, you know, his thing is we're going to go out there and compete and try to win games and whatnot. But he's definitely going to be I think he's going to have a learning curve this year in the NBA and developing a system. And I think any college coach can do it. I really think he does. He has a chance to do it. I really like what – I'll be honest. I was sitting at an education conference when they announced that he was the coach, and I about fell out of my chair. Like, I was like, John Beilein, head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers? I just felt weird. I don't know what. But, like, after doing some research and, like, thinking about it, I like what he's done. I mean, he obviously took Michigan and did a lot of great things with them. And I know college is different than the pros. But at the same time, I think he has it. And the fact that the team is pretty young, I think he's definitely good at connecting with kids. And I think that's going to be a really key asset for him is having that ability to connect with these kids that are brand new to the league. And yes, we are pretty young when it comes down to it. I think obviously we have Kevin Love and we've got, Larry Nance is a few years older than the rest of these guys. And there's a few other old, quote unquote, old heads, but for the most part, we're a pretty young team. So I think it'll be interesting to see how he connects with them and how they respond to him.
And you guys might have more of a handling on what Beilein can do than I do, because I don't follow a boltload of college hoops. So I know he runs kind of a free-flowing system. He likes to run with two guards. He likes to have positional versatility. He likes to be able to switch one through five. He wants the ball to move all over the place. I've seen some of the beautiful sets that he runs, and the people I talk to say, man, that this dude knows his stuff, and this guy can really get the most out of this roster. And so the expectations for this season, and that is the overarching thing, is what does this season look like? I still fall back to last season's rule. And it's the same thing again. I quote my buddy Jake Chapman, play well, but take the L. And that's all I want these kids to do, because I mentioned the draft pick last year. Well, they're in the same camp for this year.
Is it still top 10 protected?
Still top 10 protected draft pick. So for the love of all that's holy, don't you dare start winning games and lose that draft pick, because all of a sudden now your curve becomes so much longer than it was previously. If for some ungodly reason they start playing well enough to find themselves in a playoff conversation. And I know that's sickening for fans to hear, and I know that's bizarre for a lot of people to live in this world where you want them to do this, but this is the NBA today. This is how you are going to get better, is by getting various draft picks and getting better through there and developing a young core and then supplementing free agency around it. That's how Golden State built itself. That's how San Antonio built itself for years. That's how all these other teams were able to do it, because LeBron's not walking through that door again, kids. I'm really sorry to tell you that. It's not
Bronny Jr. Yet. Bronny Jr., man. Come on.
Well, good point. All right, so Bronny Jr. might be walking through that door, but it's going to be a little bit before he shows up. So you're going to need to play well, but you're going to need to take the L. And so I'm so fascinated to see what this is going to look like, because if they're going to play up-tempo, fun, swing the ball around, Darius Garland shooting from all over the place, Colin Sexton's game developing, Nance becoming a better passer, which is everything that we've heard in the offseason he's going to be.
Hey, speaking of
this,
Nance,
could be fun.
Dan, did you hear his quote yesterday where he said he was going to take more jumpers from inside the three-point line?
I'm so mad at him because of Chelsea Football Club not playing Christian Pulisic, but that's from a different – that's a different conversation for a different podcast.
But I shuddered when I heard him say, oh, I'm going to take more jumpers from the baseline from inside the three-point line. And I'm like, oh, God, that sounds terrible. Keep playing inside, dude. That's what you need to do. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
I know the
league's transforming into that kind of thing, but with his kind of athleticism, he should be at the rim, and that's a Kevin Love thing. Kevin Love should be shooting those shots, not you, Larry Nance. Sorry. That's just my opinion. I love you, Larry Nance.
And I'm in the same camp. Larry Nance is a really good dude, and he's a great basketball player and everything else, besides the fact that his beloved Chelsea Football Club refuses to play Christian Pulisic. But again, conversation for another day. I'm really interested to see how Kevin Love fits in here and how they use him, because Rick Adelman ran this beautiful system in Minnesota that got him the ball all over the place with the offense operating all around him. And I wonder if John Beilein is going to see some of that stuff and figure out how to funnel it through Kevin Love. Now, the only problem with funneling an offense through Kevin Love is that, let's face it, he's going to play 40 games this season, 50 games this season. And I don't think he's going to play much more than that because, again, play well, but take the L. So, like, if you got that hangnail that's acting up and it's really giving you problems, like, you probably want to take a couple weeks off and make sure that sucker is completely.
Okay, so, Dan, so of your opinion, is he going to be on the team when the season ends or no?
That contract is not ideal. Now, the cap goes up every single year, so it continues to get better every year. From what I've heard, if they get the right offer, they will move him. I don't know what the right offer is, but if they get the right offer, they will move him.
LeBron James for Kevin Love. That's the right offer.
If not, then they will continue to hold on to him and make him a focal point of this team.
Okay.
He wants to be here from everything we keep hearing. He wants to stay in Cleveland. He likes Cleveland. He likes being here. But I know there's another part of him that wants to compete. So I don't think if they were to send him to a contender, I don't think he would have a serious problem with
him.
I don't think it would be like an I'm not showing up or any of that stuff. I think he would be very happy with that opportunity. It's just he also likes it here. And he likes it in Cleveland. And they've embraced him. And it seems like he's interested in the rebuild and wants to help develop these kids and work with them along the way, knowing that maybe the fruits of his labor won't be seen until either A, this contract is done, or B, he's playing for somewhere else.
Okay, so we've kind of hinted at this a little bit, but what do you think the best case scenario is for the Cavs this year, Dan?
Play well, take the L. I'm telling you, 25 wins. That's the best case scenario for this team. 25 wins. And the reason that I say that is they would be better than they were last year. The kids would continue to develop and get better, play a lot of really close games, be in them in the fourth quarter, all of those things that you're looking for, and then come up empty because you're in draft pick acquisition mode. And the other great part of the season would be that by the time the trade deadline hits, guys like John Hanson, Matthew Dellavedova, Tristan Thompson, down the line from there, find themselves on other teams with assets coming back for multiple picks in the draft. That's your best case scenario.
And what's the worst case scenario, Dan?
They're the eighth seed. That's the worst case scenario. They're the eighth seed. The seventh or the eighth seed. And again, this is one man's opinion, and I'm sure you will get some Cavs fans that will get a hold of you in some way, shape, or form and tell you something completely different. I just think for the long-term future of this team, the worst place that they could be right now is the seventh or the eighth seed. Unless that arrow is pointing straight up and they are there because Darius Garland is the truth. And they are there because Colin Sexton is a completely different monster than what he was. And they're there because Michael Porter Jr. lives up to every little bit of the hype that we heard about at USC. And they're there because Dylan Windler is the greatest version of a three-point shooter who can board like there's no tomorrow. And if that's the reason they're there, then I'm in hook, line, and sinker, and this is phenomenal. What scares me more than anything else, Jason, is that they're going to be there because Kevin Love plays 82 games, and they win way more games than they should. And now all of a sudden, they're sitting there stuck with the 8 seed or the 7 seed, and the arrow is not pointing straight into the air. Instead, it's only like slightly tilted upward, and they don't have the first-round pick to fire back with.
Yeah, I could not agree with you even more than you just said. I think the 8th seed, and I'm going to go out. We're going to do an NBA preview pod with you and Mike closer to when the season starts, and we'll make our formal Cavs predictions on that pod. We won't say anything. I'm really, really scared, Dan, that for some godforsaken reason, Kevin Love is going to play a lot of games this year, and they're going to be competing for that playoff spot. And Mike looks at me every time I say that and shudders and says there's no way. I don't know what it is in my bones that says that. Maybe that's just the optimist in me, which you know me well enough. I'm not really that much of an optimist. Look at my fantasy football team. But I just don't understand why they would go for it, and I just think that they're going to. And the other underlying factor here, Dan, is we don't know what's going on with Dan Gilbert.
Million-dollar question. And it's because Dan Gilbert wants a title. Dan Gilbert wants a title more than anything else on the planet. And Dan Gilbert, this was the same guy who had a clock in his office that counted up every single minute, was a day, hour, minute, and second since the last time that a Cleveland sports team won a title. And you know he reset that clock after 2016, and he's continuing to look at it. Well, and his health is a concern.
That's the big thing. I mean, Fred McLeod passed away, and he wasn't at Fred McLeod's funeral.
RIP to Fred. Fred is awesome. Such an awesome dude. Such a bummer for the organization.
They haven't announced his replacement yet, right?
Yeah, John Michael will be taking over for Fred McLeod, and Tim Alcorn will be taking over for the radio side because John Michael was on the radio side initially.
Okay, yeah, so that's interesting. I was really making a push that they would have try to get Allie back. I thought that this was her time, but she's kind of embedded with the Lakers at this point, so I wanted Allie Clifton back.
I'm biased. I wanted Phelpsy, but I'm also biased. I wanted Jeff Phelps to get it.
We've talked about best case and worst case scenario. We've talked about all these other things. And like I said before, Dan and I will talk with Mike about our overall NBA predictions another time. Dan, I can't thank you enough for hopping on and talking Cavs a little bit tonight.
No worries, brother. It was an absolute blast to do it. And to all of you Cavs fans out there who are pulling for the eighth seed, stop. Just stop it now. Realize that the future of your ball club lies at the college level. Watch a boatload of college basketball and enjoy every bit of it and flip over to the Cavs every so often, because as we're all asking of them, please, 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 to the entire organization, play the kids and play well, but for the love of all that's holy, take the L.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks, Dan. We'll catch you on our next episode.
Thanks, brother.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game. The Detroit Pistons with Matt Shook from the Locked On Pistons podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, Matt Shook from Locked On Pistons podcast. Matt, first of all, I want to go back and talk a little bit about last year's Pistons season. Give us a quick recap of kind of where the Pistons ended last year and how that led them into what they did this offseason.
Yeah, so thanks for guys having me, first of all. But yeah, it was pretty much as mediocre as you could imagine of a season for the Detroit Pistons. And fittingly, 41-41. It doesn't get any more poetic than that, to go 41-41 in the season. But, you know, the goal was to make the playoffs, and they did that. Snuck in on the last day of the season as the eighth seed. Kind of a late swoon to fall out of the end of that 6-7-8 range. So fell to the bottom of eighth, but luckily did edge out Charlotte and Miami for that eighth spot. And then got the pleasure of getting the Milwaukee Bucks in the first round, and it was a quick one as Blake Griffin missed the first two games of the playoffs because of a knee injury that he flared up late in the season. And yeah, the Bucks took care of him very easily. The games 3 and 4 at Little Caesars Arena were the first two playoff games in LCA history. The Pistons have not won a playoff game since 2008 still, but fans were pretty excited for that games 3 and 4. I mean, they caught some mainstream attention here in the Michigan sports media market, and sports mainstream filled the building for a couple games and really played pretty competitively in both of those games at home. And I know it sounds very participation trophy, very also ran to say that coming close in playoff games and almost winning one game is something to feel proud about. But that's where we're at after about a decade of mediocrity at best with this team after so many great years before that.
Yeah, I'm sure the fan base there has got to be pretty hungry for a winner. I know during the time when the Bad Boys were there and they had sort of the glory days of Pistons basketball with the Chauncey Billups, Rip Hamilton group, that those fans were super supportive of the team, and I'm sure they got to be really hungry to get this thing turned around and get them headed in the right direction.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's the whole, you look at it from a macro level, like I said, it's the Michigan sports scene right now. The four major Detroit teams are basically in the toilet. The Lions, I mean, who knows, you know, they're kind of perpetually in the toilet until proven otherwise. And then even the college football teams that are Michigan State and Michigan are certainly above average teams, but flaws of their own. So it's a depressed state to be a sports fan here in the state of Michigan. I'm 36 years old. The first 25 years or so of my life, there was always a team competing for a championship year in and year out. I kind of went in waves on which ones it would be. But man, like I got to say, it's almost a decade now of complete failure. And really, 6 or 7 of these past years have been as bad as it gets.
Matt, I can vouch for the fact that the Detroit Lions have not been good, because since I was a little kid, and I have no connection to Detroit whatsoever, I have no family there, I have nothing, but ever since I can remember, there's a picture of me at like 5 years old wearing a Detroit Lions helmet. I have always been a Lions fan. So the fact that I am a Cleveland Browns fan and a Detroit Lions fan, I always tell people that no one can accuse me of being a football bandwagoner, because if I am, I have hitched my bandwagon to two of the worst franchises in professional sports history that have never sniffed the Super Bowl. So I'm at least right there with you on the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, that's quite a 1-2 punch you got there with the Lions and Browns. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. So what's Blake Griffin's health like now heading into this season? What's the talk there?
Yeah, he had a scope, sounds like a meniscus injury at the end of last year, and it cut into his offseason a little bit. But you know, the question is whether it's arthritic or not. Is there long-term problems? Because we know about Blake Griffin's long injury career. Sorry for the faux pas there. But yeah, he's had so many injuries that you really can't rely on full health. I think if Dwayne Casey and the coaching staff really took a big look in the mirror this past offseason, they would probably find some more ways for that load management, the favorite term among the NBA fans and media these days. I think the Pistons need to give Blake the second half of back-to-backs, or one of the halves of a back-to-back off, and really start thinking of sitting him down some more, minutes limits, all those good things. So, yeah, it's fine. I mean, his health is okay coming into the season, but as far as how much wear and tear you can do over 82, we've got real questions here.
So, with that being said, let's talk about some of the roster moves that the Pistons made this offseason and how that's going to impact what they look like on the floor this year. Let's talk about who they brought in, who they lost from last season, and then what impact that may have out on the court in 2019-2020.
Yeah, everything's kind of been around the margins. Didn't have a lot of salary cap to play with because you got Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond and Reggie Jackson on big contracts. So kind of a shrewd move in getting rid of John Luehr and acquiring Tony Snell from the Milwaukee Bucks. And that, you know, it's a player who's get a high number in his contract. So you were able to get him from a team that's trying to free up some cap, take care of their things long term. So used kind of a negative asset to get a little bit of a positive asset in Tony Snell, who will probably be their starter at small forward, and used all the exceptions and whatever cap room was able to be scraped about for Derrick Rose on a 2-year deal this offseason, and show me deals kind of on Markieff Morris and Tim Frazier being guaranteed contracts. But Joe Johnson this past week picked up on a show me deal, partially guaranteed, who the training camp invite. And also brought in Christian Wood. And it seems like Joe Johnson and Christian Wood are kind of competing for that 15th spot on the roster. And they also drafted Sekou Doumbouya out of France, the 18-year-old, who is the youngest player in the NBA right now on a roster. And very raw, certainly a guy that you don't expect to make a big contribution in his rookie year. But kind of maybe the guy that you hope is able to move the needle for this group on the talent level wise, you know, basis in the next few years, if you're able to develop him like he might be able to be developed. The losses are Ish Smith is the backup point guard. He's been a nice player for the Pistons for a few years. Glenn Robinson III, who didn't work out on a 1+1 deal that the Pistons declined the team option on this past season. And then Zaza Pachulia and Jose Calderon, who were veterans that they had brought in to kind of be insurance policies that worked out in Zaza's case for the most part, and Jose Calderon. And you might know down in Cleveland, pretty much washed at this point in his career. So.
What does the Reggie Jackson, Derrick Rose point guard position, I don't want to call it a battle necessarily, might be too strong of a word, but how does that play out, the relationship between those guys? Is there any talk about how they're going to work together, fit together, how the minutes might be distributed between those two?
Yeah, I think that that's probably one of the biggest questions coming into the season is, you know, Reggie Jackson's kind of the presumed starter out of those guys, and Derrick Rose, like you know, has some pretty really good moments during his career, and obviously some decent moments in Minnesota last year. Really shot the ball well from three in the first half of the season before that fell off a cliff in the second half of the year. It's obviously not something he's done well throughout his career, but I would imagine that you're going to see something like a 50-50 split. And there's even talk of, and I believe it, that you might see sometimes where they're on the court together. Now, with Reggie Jackson and Ish Smith last year, Dwayne Casey wasn't afraid to keep Ish Smith in there for the stretch run of games if he was playing better, if Reggie was having an off game. So, yeah, I would kind of expect him to go with the hot hand and kind of see how things materialize as the year goes on.
All right, best case, worst case scenario for the Pistons. What's the best case scenario for them as you look at what their season could potentially be?
I think that the best case scenario is that someone takes a really big step forward in terms of the young players. I think the most obvious choice of that would be Luke Kennard. If he takes a leap and becomes kind of a night in, reliable scorer for this team, he may not start once again just because the fit in the starting lineup with guys like Blake Griffin and Reggie Jackson hasn't been great in his time in Detroit. But if he's able to play, you know, the amount of starter minutes that a starter would play, and like I said, become that consistent impact scorer on the team, I think that's the best path for a best case scenario for the Pistons. Of course, looking around the Eastern Conference, if things maybe don't work out as well with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn, if Jimmy Butler in Miami don't click right away, and if Orlando kind of stagnates with that group that they have right there. And then if you want to get really, really optimistic and think that, you know, Victor Oladipo's injury prolongs and that Toronto has issues kind of on a championship hangover without Kawhi Leonard and the uncertainty around Kyle Lowry and what's going on there. Like I said, best case scenario, this team could possibly get all the way up to like a fifth seed or something like that. They win 45, 47 games. But again, that's talking best case scenario.
All right, worst case scenario, what does that look like?
The worst case scenario is the Pistons had really remarkable luck last year with the injuries with Blake Griffin and Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson played all 82 games, and Blake Griffin is injury history is well chronicled. And then you throw Derrick Rose into that mix too. So I mean, I know that all teams in the NBA, a bunch of injuries is the worst case scenario, but it's a very real scenario for the Pistons going into this season. And you're looking at a team that's looking at the February trade deadline, thinking Reggie Jackson's on a expiring deal. Andre Drummond has a player option coming up this summer too. Maybe those guys are expendable at the trade deadline, and then you're kind of back on the outside of the playoff picture, but not bad enough to secure one of the top picks of the draft.
What's your take on the long-term prospects of keeping Blake and Drummond together? Does that pairing make sense if you can build the rest of the, if you can build the rest of the roster up around them? Is that a duo that can advance you, maybe not to a championship level, but could that be a team, if you built the right team around them, that they could maybe get to a conference final if you had the right pieces around them? What's your take on those two guys being able to play together out on the floor?
Yeah, Andre Drummond is such a lightning rod with this fan base, and I'm a little bit more on, and I don't take hot takes on a lot of things on the Locked On Pistons show, but I'm a little bit more on the negative side of Andre Drummond, especially given the way that Blake Griffin played last year. I mean, he's obviously the best player on this team, and the guy you want with the ball in his hands, and just the way that the NBA is right now. And it sounds enticing in some ways to just throw shooters around those guys and see how it goes. And obviously the Pistons haven't done the maximum of what they could do around those two guys in terms of the roster. But to me, I find a hard time believing that Andre Drummond's going to be the best or second best player on a team that really is going to have those championship aspirations. And he's, you know, he has improved some aspects of his game throughout the last few years, most famously his free throws, which have been, you know, so bad a few years ago, have turned into just regular bad and even kind of good at times these last couple years. So to me, the fact that Andre Drummond's looking at next summer as a possible opt-out for him, and a lot of, not a lot of teams with a lot of cap space, but a lot of bad teams that have enough cap space to offer a big money deal. I think that the Pistons, in the back of their minds, and I know that it's probably an organization that's split in a lot of ways with this big topic that they have to deal with next summer, but I think that if Andre Drummond walked away, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And I think that, you know, building a more conventional NBA team that has, you know, one good, you know, quote unquote post player, and then starts building more around the wings and the perimeter, I think that's probably the model that they're that would most likely lead to future success for this franchise.
All right. So all that being said, where do you see the Pistons finishing out when mid-April rolls around in 2020? Where do you see them finishing up in the standings, and you see them making the playoffs, and where do you see their season finishing out?
Yeah, I know I might sound a little doom and gloom with some of the things I've said so far, but I am an optimist. I've kind of, you know, we do this show every day here on the Locked On Podcast Network, and we talk about the Pistons. So I'm not going to talk about a team that I dislike or hate or anything. I do like this team. I do like that Blake Griffin is one of the more interesting, to me, athletes in the sport right now. And I think that he's a fun guy to watch night in and night out. So I'm not going to predict that the Pistons are going to be befell with injuries. Obviously, it's something that's on the table. So I'm going to say a slight improvement over 41-41 last year. I'll give them 43 games, and I'll even say that they're going to sneak up to the seventh seed in the Eastern Conference. I don't know about some of these other teams at the bottom of the East playoff race, and I will make the bold prediction that the Pistons will win their first playoff game since 2008. I won't say series, but they'll win their first playoff game since 2008, and we'll be able to knock that streak down and move on with our lives, hopefully in a better direction as years
nice.
Go on.
Nice. I like it. Do you think they have any chance to win a first round series if something would break right?
Yeah, I think
matchups.
Yeah, I think that matchups is what it's all about. And unfortunately, the way that the last few weeks of the season went last year with Blake Griffin having the injury right at the wrong time, they dropped some games that they shouldn't have then. And it avoided them from getting, you know, Philadelphia or Toronto. And, of course, don't get me wrong in that I'm predicting that they'd be anywhere close to winning the series against these teams. But, you know, the Pistons took four from Toronto during the season. They had the Dwayne Casey thing that they could play for. And just the way that Andre Drummond and Brook Lopez, while I believe that Andre Drummond is a better player than Brook Lopez, it's just one of those matchups that's a nightmare for Andre Drummond. He was kind of exposed during that series, whereas, you know, Karl Anthony Towns clearly a better player than Andre Drummond, but that's a guy that Drummond is just kind of eaten alive throughout his entire career. Karl Anthony Towns has never beaten the Pistons. So, yeah, I think that the Pistons could have landed on a good matchup in that first round, they could have won a game, possibly even two games, or maybe even made a couple of games competitive and losing in five or something like that. And the optimist in me thinks that a competitive first round series is possible for this group, and we're going to go on a limb and predict.
Matt, can't thank you enough for jumping on the Hoopheads Pod NBA preview with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys.
The Indiana Pacers with Tony East from the Locked On Pacers Podcast.
We'd like to welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast tonight as part of our NBA 2019-2020 preview show, Tony East from the Locked On Pacers Podcast, to talk some Indiana Pacers with us tonight. Tony, welcome.
Happy to be here. Happy to talk about the team that I so love to talk about these days.
So let's go back, first of all, and look at their season last year. Talk a little bit about what was good, what was bad. Obviously, the Oladipo injury had a huge impact on the second half of the season and what they were able to do in the playoffs. Just give us a little quick recap of where the Pacers were heading into the offseason, and then we'll talk about some of the key acquisitions they've made and some of the personnel losses they had over the summer.
Yeah, you nailed the differentiator in their season being that injury, which really makes it almost two seasons or three if you really want to get grainy, but I think two is a better way to describe it. They're with Oladipo season and they're without Oladipo season, because when Oladipo was playing, they were really good. I mean, not good like could win a series, good like 57 win pace good, and that, you know, that's close to where the Bucks and Raptors, who ended up squaring off in the conference finals, ended up. They were beating up everybody. They looked like a force to be reckoned with. He missed some time in late November and early December. They went 500 in those games. And then obviously he goes down in late January and they finished 500 exactly, I believe, without him playing to end the season. So it was really two seasons. It was one iteration of their roster that was really awesome and could compete with the top of the East, and that they were achieving their goals. And there was another group that was a bunch of players who were designed to fit with this star shooting guard that didn't have the star shooting guard. So they were not equipped to do all the things they wanted to do. Come playoff time, that showed. You know, the Celtics just destroyed them, four-game sweep. And really the season just became defined by, did they make the right call by going for it and not trading guys at the trade deadline, and less about their actual success, which is a bummer and is the nature of the way that the news cycle and the narratives go when you have a big injury like that.
What's Oladipo's status right now? How's it looking as far as him being able to come back at full strength? When's he expected to be back playing at full capacity?
President of Basketball Operations, Kevin Pritchard, and Adrian Wojnarowski, who might as well be the head of PR for every team at this point.
no doubt about that.
Have both said December, January return date, which Kevin Pritchard in Summer League was doing a sideline interview for a broadcast and, you know, talked about how that's more of their conservative timeline, but they don't want to rush it with him because there's no point. I mean, they have so much. We'll talk about this in a second, but they have so much roster turnover, and it's not like they're punting on the season. They still have a bunch of good players, but there's no point of rushing it in a time of change and things like that. So it looks like he'll miss the first 2 months of the season, but we've seen videos of him running at Miami's football stadium in Florida, and that's where he trained in the summer. And then he went to IU, his alma mater, and was, you know, doing crossovers and lateral movement and stuff. So he looks like he's like doing all the directions of movement and stuff, but it's about, you know, can he put equal weight on both legs and things like that, that, well, I personally do not understand. But seems like we're a while off.
You got to imagine it has something to do with being in the Eastern Conference too. They don't need to rush it, let's be honest.
Right, absolutely. I mean,
so, you know, they're going to be a shoe-in for the playoffs probably without him. So I think they probably can be a little more cautious, so to speak.
Well, and since we're talking about it, like, if they're the five seed, but Oladipo's back, like, they're the five seed because he missed 30 games, right? So they're probably the favorite in a 5-4 matchup in that instance anyway. So they're, you know, rushing him back adds no value to that. Like, what does home court really matter in that instance?
They're definitely much better off having him come back and be healthy for the playoffs. Don't want to rush him in any way so that he comes back into the lineup and then he's at 75% capacity. In the long term, they're going to be much better off. Maybe the regular season record isn't as good, but heading into the playoffs next April, if he's healthy, they're going to be a much more formidable opponent for anybody that they're going to face in round one of the playoffs. Let's look at some of the Pacers roster moves over the summer, some of the key losses and key additions to the team, and how that's going to impact them this coming season.
Well, this section is longer than it'll be for most other people you talk to. They had five or six rotation players gone this summer. Darren Collison retired instead of playing for the Bulls. Corey Joseph went to Sacramento. Wesley Matthews went to Milwaukee. Kyle O'Quinn went to Philadelphia. Bojan Bogdanovic went to Utah. Thaddeus Young did go to Chicago instead of in lieu of retiring. That's a joke that Darren Collison say that he retired instead of playing for the Bulls. But, you know, they had a bunch of key contributors from last year leave, which in turn opened up a lot of cap space, but it's a lot of holes to fill. So it's kind of, you know, fake cap space. You can't spend it all in one place. So they brought in Malcolm Brogdon from the Bucks. He was their big ticket guy, talented guy, of course, like the consummate role player, right? He's not a star by any means, but he's the absolute apex of what a role player can be, and the perfect fit next to Oladipo when both are healthy. Perfect spend to me if I was asked about that. Jeremy Lamb and T.J. Warren were brought in to kind of be offensive initiators when Victor Oladipo's off the floor and injured, and then Goga Bitadze was drafted to be the backup center because the biggest move was actually not a roster move, but just a decision, and that's that Domantas Sabonis is now going to start at the power forward spot alongside Miles Turner. So lots of change to the rotation. Oh, and Justin Holiday was brought in as a backup wing too. So lots of change to the rotation that filled a lot of needed holes and needed roles because a lot of guys left this summer.
Hey, you can never have too many holidays, right?
They have all three TJs in the NBA, and then two of the three Holiday brothers. They're just filling it up.
I was going to say, you have TJ McConnell. He's one of my favorites. I really like him.
Yeah, he is interesting because I'm not sure if he's necessarily here to do any playing or if he's just here to be like a vet because Justin Holiday's 30, and then their next oldest player is 26 or 27. They're a really young group now. So McConnell's like a vet on this roster. It's been like being in the league for 4 years. I don't know if he'll play necessarily with Aaron Holiday there. Of course, Holiday is the shortest least ever because he's a sophomore, so maybe he can step in if he stinks. But, yeah, I think he's just here to be a vet and bring camaraderie and chemistry.
What's your take on the Sabonis-Miles Turner pairing? What do you think long-term? Is that going to be something that – is this year going to be the key to determining whether or not they're going to eventually re-sign or keep both of those guys long-term? What's your own personal feeling on whether or not that's going to work out?
Well, that's the question, right, about this roster. No matter how good Vic can be, the question is their ceiling capped by having two centers starting together? You know, anecdotally, it just seems like Turner can shoot, Sabonis can play the post. These guys can kind of fit together. One's behind the perimeter, one's not. And then on the defensive end, one can protect the rim, like stick him under the basket, have the other one try to figure out perimeter D a little bit. Like, in theory, it kind of seems like it just should work. But in reality, it just doesn't look like it does. Their net rating was positive last year, and it was pretty good against playoff teams that weren't the Celtics, too. But it just doesn't look like it works, and they kind of get in each other's way and don't know when to cut, and only Sabonis can pass, right? So if Turner has the ball, things just kind of are dead in terms of running a set or an action anyway. So it's weird that it outscored other teams. Like, you can't just dismiss that completely, but you look at it on the court, and it's like, how this is weird. So just because it seems like it should work doesn't mean it will work, but I think it has a good chance. I mean, now that they'll have more minutes together, I'm sure they can get more rhythm and figure more stuff out. And I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt because they did mostly outscore their teams with those two on the floor. But just watching it, it's kind of awkward and hard to say that it can be like the best thing for the team. So we'll see.
I agree. If they can make that work, those are definitely two talented guys who, if they can figure out a way to play together and take advantage of both of their skill sets, that definitely raises the ceiling for the Pacers, not just for this season, but for their future long-term as well.
Let's talk best case, worst case scenarios for the Pacers. So best case, what does this season look like from a Pacers standpoint? And then flip it around, what's the worst case scenario for the Pacers this year?
Well, kind of a big part of that answer falls back on what we just talked about with Sabonis and Turner, right? Their best case is those two from the jump, great, perfect. One of the best front court combos in the league. They're kicking Horford and Embiid's butts. They're able to slow down Giannis enough. They can, you know, work well enough on offense or even be really good. You know, it all is clicking, and then Brogdon is good and doesn't get hurt, and T.J. Warren also doesn't get hurt. You know, these are a lot of ifs, but, like, that's what the best-case scenario is, right? So all this stuff happens, and then Oladipo just is inserted into this already very good team, and they're really good. And they're probably conference finals level, just shy of that team this year. You know, they're probably – tick behind Milwaukee and Philly, even at full strength. But if everything goes great with Sabonis and Turner, maybe they're at that level. So that's the best case. And there's a lot of stuff that has to go right, but none of them on their own are so unreasonable. the worst case is the flip side. You know, Brogdon, injury-prone guys, had foot problems for his whole career. TJ Warren's never played more than 66 games. I'm sure he's going to miss time, and he's their only wing, basically. Oladipo maybe doesn't come back at the same level he has been. Turner and Sabonis don't fit, and all of a sudden you have five or six guys in your rotation with questions about, you know, who they can play with and what they can bring to your team, and you're really digging down deep in their rotation to get contributions. You know, that worst case scenario might involve them even having a losing record. They just wouldn't be getting enough from all these guys that they expected to get a lot from. So they have a pretty wide range of outcomes, just given that they have a lot of questions, although I think a lot of the questions, the answer is going to be on the positive side, just given the history that a lot of the guys have.
So all that being said, where do you fall on how you see the Pacers finishing next season? Where are they going to end up in the Eastern Conference standings? And then what do you see them being able to accomplish in the playoffs come next April?
I've run through their schedule a bunch, and most of the time I end up in the 43 to 45 range of wins. If I do a best-case scenario, it's like 51, 52. If I do a worst-case, it's like 38. So usually right in the middle of those two, the 44, 45 range is what I think they'll end up about. What that ends up being depends kind of on how the East shakes out. But, you know, if Miami and Detroit and Brooklyn and Orlando are all kind of what people think they are and they're a little above 500, then maybe their seed is, you know, they're fighting for a good seed and their first-round opponent dictates how far they can go in the playoffs. If those four teams I just mentioned kind of are exactly 500 teams, then the Pacers can be the five seed, and they'll, like I said earlier, be one of the better five seeds, just given that, Victor Oladipo is going to miss 2 months. Like, they'll be better than their record come playoff time. They've got a chance in that series. If they can avoid either of the big two and maybe Boston in the first round, I think they have a chance to beat anybody in the postseason. So if they can hit it strong at 45 wins and have the four or five seed, I think they have a good shot to win at least one round.
Fantastic. Tony, thanks for jumping on the Hoopheads podcast with us to preview the Indiana Pacers. Again, Tony is from the Locked On Pacers podcast, so make sure you give him a follow. Make sure you give him a listen. Tony, we can't thank you enough for jumping on the podcast with us, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up with you at some point during the upcoming NBA season. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The Milwaukee Bucks with Jordan Tresky from the Win in Six podcast.
Tonight, we're welcoming to the NBA Preview Extravaganza podcast here on the Hoopheads, Jordan Tresky from the Win in Six podcast to talk Milwaukee Bucks basketball. Jordan, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are very excited to talk Bucks with you. Let's start out by going back to last season and just kind of wrap up what I know was a great season, an exciting season, but ultimately had to be a disappointing season for Milwaukee fans, that they couldn't finish it off, especially in light of the fact that once Toronto beat them, and then the wounded Warriors were waiting for Toronto. And I think if Milwaukee had gotten past Toronto, you guys had been celebrating an NBA title. So it had to be a little bit of a disappointing end. So just kind of give us a quick recap of last year.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Mike Budenholzer comes in the wake of the Jason Kidd era, goes from 44 win team and just kind of like, you know, by the end of Kidd's time in Milwaukee, was just basically largely an underachieving team, considering, you know, he wasn't the MVP yet, but you still have a superstar in Giannis growing before our eyes, and you have a good nucleus of talent. And then obviously just everything changes when Bud walks in the door, and, you know, it doesn't just fall on his shoulders. You get Brook Lopez, you have a good offseason with getting, you know, bolstering your depth. You go win 60 games. And obviously, I think that obviously played, you know, far better than anybody's expectations heading into the year. And just kind of transformed into this like contender overnight, basically. And then obviously, like you mentioned, you roll through the season, go through the first round sweeping the Pistons. You had a little trouble in game one against the Celtics, but after that was pretty easy. And then, you know, go up 2-0 in the East Conference Finals, you kind of thinking like this might actually happen. And then literally the worst case scenario, the bottom falls out. They lose four games in a row. They hadn't even, at that point, they only lost two games in a row once at that point in the season. So losing four games in a row against a very good Toronto team, obviously won the championship. But like that just kind of, no one expected that at all, especially just how they were, got through all the injuries and just were looking like they were, you know, poised to at least go to the finals. But yeah, that just the way that things ended just kind of soured. And you look at all the things, the achievements, all that stuff, and kind of look back on it fondly, but it's very hard to kind of look past just how big of a collapse that was in the conference finals.
No question about that. What do you attribute that to? What do you think changed, or what do you think caused that sudden shift where it just seemed like they had it rolling and then suddenly, boom, it was like, as you said, the bottom fell out. Do you think it was the performance of certain players? Do you think it was a scheme type thing? What do you think? What do you attribute it to?
You can look at like a bunch of things, honestly. Like, you know, Giannis wasn't really himself and he had a lot of attention go his way. And I don't think, you know, as great as he is, there's obvious ways where you can combat his, you know, shooting limitations for sure. But I just think Toronto, I mean, everything that you could say about, like, you know, criticize just the Bucks and maybe lack of experience going that far in the playoffs. I mean, virtually outside of like George Hill or even Brooke Lopez, I don't think any of the core pieces really won a playoff series at that point, obviously. And I just think Toronto really just kind of, they figured out how to really stymie their offense and just kind of make it harder for, you know, what were normally good looks for them in the regular season into the playoffs at that point. They just bothered them enough to kind of throw them off their game. They obviously played Nikola Mirotic off the floor to, now he's basically overseas. That kind of is a weird, just like, oh, that's, he was a key contributor for that team and just, you know, leaves the league all to get altogether. But obviously anything that you kind of look at the Bucks play and just everything, it just kind of, you look back at Toronto, just how much of a cohesive unit they were at by that point in the season and in their run too.
Yeah. They really put it together right at the right time. It seemed like Giannis, I think you hit that right on the head, that he was just maybe a shade below where he had been for the entire regular season and heading into the, you know, the first and second round of the playoffs. And those first two games, it just seemed like he was just this unstoppable force. And then when Toronto was able to throw Kawhi at him, throw Pascal Siakam at him, and just seems like they made it just hard enough and the other guys weren't quite good enough to be able to make up for that little bit of slight dip in Giannis's play. And so it'll be interesting to say, I'm reading this from afar, but Giannis strikes me as a type of guy who that loss burned on him all summer, and he's going to come back with even more of a vengeance. Are you hearing that just over there in Milwaukee? Is that sort of a part of the storyline going into training camp and into the season?
Oh yeah. I mean, Giannis is, he is, just the drive, and, you know, he's just this athletic specimen and everything. Like, he's just a crazy athlete. But I think the thing about him more than anything, as we kind of see him mature and into this, you know, obvious superstar, NBA superstar, he's just insanely competitive and just has this insane drive that no one can really contain unless, if, you know, I mean, it's just insane just how he kind of operates day to day and just always wants to get better and always wants to get better. And obviously not just, you know, the way his season ended last year, but has some obviously obvious struggles in the World Cup. And he even talked about it a little bit after last night's preseason game, and just kind of how that was a very different animal than anything he's been used to. And I think his quote was something like saying, like, he prefers the NBA game way more than, you know, how the FIBA game is, kind of controlled overseas and stuff like that. So it's just kind of, he's definitely motivated to kind of push back all the, just the way last year ended, basically.
Yeah, he's certainly a guy that if you look at where he was when he came into the league and you look at where he is now, the progress that he's made in terms of his skill level and also his body. I think I was online, I can't remember exactly where I saw it, but there was like a picture of him, must have been from Media Day his rookie year. And then his picture from Media Day this year, and just the transformation of just his body from when he was a rookie to what he looks like now. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I guess, you know, you kind of knew that happened, but to see it start so starkly presented, I'm like, man, this guy has busted his tail and really worked. And I hope that,
you know, his jumper gets to the point where at least teams have to respect him, because once you put that piece of it in place, I mean, he's already unstoppable, or as close to unstoppable as you can be. And if he gets any kind of a jumper, I think, man, the sky is going to continue to be the limit for him. And I think that I just think he's coming back with a vengeance. I told we did our preview last year, and I had Giannis as the MVP before the season, so I was proven right about one thing, and I'm sure wrong about many, many others. But I think he's gonna be in for an even better season this year. Now the challenge becomes with the roster. How big of a loss is Brogdon, and what's the plan for replacing him?
That's kind of the big question for at least the regular season. Is just they obviously move on from Malcolm Brogdon. They get veterans like Wes Matthews, Kyle Korver, very proven 3-point shooters, but certainly not the player that Malcolm Brogdon was for this Bucks team. And that in itself, like the reasons for why they kind of moved on from Brogdon and why that was much of a shock is obviously it's impossible to untangle like the financial circumstances on it and just the luxury tax question on it. But, you know, Malcolm Brogdon had a 50-40-90 season last year. And yeah, he was hurt for, you know, the end of the season and kind of that trickled into the playoffs, but he comes back and was very valuable contributor to them throughout that Raptor series too. Obviously they're hoping not just guys like Korver and Matthews step up and obviously can hit some threes and replicate, you know, what you lost with Brogdon shooting, but you kind of have like this semi kind of nucleus off to the side of like developing wings like Pat Connaughton, Dante DiVincenzo, who was their first-round pick from the 2018 draft. Sterling Brown, a guy that they've really liked, and he's kind of shown glimpses and flashes over time the last couple of years. So it's going to be by committee in how they replace them all together, just whether that will win out, and obviously the stakes are incredibly high. We'll just have to see if that decision ends up being, you know, to how they would like it to be at the end of the year.
So if you had to put money on it, which one of those three younger guys, Brown, DiVincenzo, or Connaughton, if you had to put money on it, when the playoffs roll around, which one of those guys do you think is going to be playing the biggest role for this team if you had to pick one of them?
Ooh, that's a good question. Sterling started early on in their playoff run last year, and he looked decent, but I think I would probably lean a little more Pat Connaughton because he's a really good athlete. He's a really good defender. It's just for him, it just kind of, and it obviously applies to Dante and Sterling to lesser extents, but he just really kind of needs to hit the three ball more consistently. And he kind of fell out of the rotation a little bit last year, but by the last like 2 months in their season, he really kind of refound his stroke. And he averaged almost or over 20 minutes in the playoffs last year. He was really kind of underrated key depth piece for them by the end of that year. And I think he could probably fill in kind of a little bit what they are hoping to kind of fill with, like, you know, losing Brogdon or even, you know, so on if your veterans are kind of, I guess, exposed at that point of the year.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that'd be the guy that I would probably pick two out of those three. Sterling Brown seems like a guy who he's always going to be destined to sort of be an eighth, ninth, tenth man. That's just the way it seems to me. And DiVincenzo, I'm not sure. You know, obviously, he lost a lot of his regular season last year to injury, and so he's still be coming back as a second-year player. I think Connaughton showed in the playoffs that he's a guy that at least has the potential to be somebody who could be part of a winning championship rotation. So I think I won't be surprised if he ends up being the guy that fills that role at the end. What is the thought on Eric Bledsoe? What's the fan base feeling about after Bledsoe's somewhat meltdown in that Toronto series and just kind of in the playoffs in general? Obviously, he had a great regular season, tremendous defensively. But when you're around Giannis, you got to be able to knock down some threes and be confident shooting it. So where's Bledsoe's game at right now?
I mean, that's the big question that is also lurking with, you know, losing a guy like Brogdon, where Brogdon, you know, he does have questions. He's not a perfect player, but for this Bucks team, he was kind of just did so many little things that you just don't know how you'll move on without, you know, seeing the breadth of his skills not being there. You know what I mean? With Bledsoe, I mean, like you said, like regular season, Eric Bledsoe is, as we've seen since he came to Milwaukee, he's a really good player. He's on the all first team all defense, named to first team all defense last year. But just, you know, two straight years in the playoffs and just kind of these weird, like, what's going on, man? Like, you just kind of lose confidence in his shot. Just kind of, he just looks the antithesis of what he, you know, has had been playing for much of the year. And obviously that doesn't help the Bucks any favors at, you know, when literally this is high leverage basketball situations and you're trying to like depend on your best guys and one of them goes down or just kind of, you know, is stuck in no man's land as he has been for the last couple of years. Like, I don't know. It's one of those questions where until the playoffs roll around, you just don't know the answer to. And that's kind of the frightening thing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you're looking at it and going, man, he could have another great regular season, and all those questions are still going to linger, not only in the fan base's mind, but I'm sure in his mind and his teammates' mind and the coaching staff's mind that, you know, is this guy going to be able to come through in the biggest moments? And I think that could really end up being the key, because if he can't be effective, you know, George Hill had some nice moments in the playoffs, but he gets older every year. And I'm not sure that you how much you want to depend on George Hill to carry you to, you know, as your second or third player to carry you to an NBA title. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays itself out. And then the last roster addition that we didn't talk about is reuniting the Lopez brothers. I got to believe that some mascots might be in danger there in Milwaukee.
Yeah, they've certainly played that up. We've already, two preseason games in, we've already seen them play together, both Robin and Brooke. And that's kind of at first it felt like this novelty looked like, oh, that'll be fun. And but it's like, oh, we're going right to it.
Yeah. Run a little Lopez to Lopez pick and roll.
Hey, Mike, I take offense. You said the last roster edition. What about Mike Budenholzer's facial hair? Like, that's what's going on there? Can you explain that to us? What did he explain what he's doing here?
I don't know. It's a very, there was this like town hall kind of event where it's kind of like this, I want to say it was like this unofficial media day, and all of a sudden just like, oh, there's Coach Bud with a beard. Oh, okay. Like, let's roll with this, I guess. And it's been past media day, and now in preseason he has it. I wonder if it's one of those things where once the season officially starts, he'll shave it. But it's a look.
He never struck me as a beard guy. He wouldn't have been high on my. He wouldn't have been high on my list of coaches I would have thought would have broken out with a beard.
Yeah, I would not have anticipated that at all.
Hey, maybe it's like he's gonna grow it out, man. I don't know. I think it's a good look, man. I don't know.
I'm assuming, Jordan, that's not the biggest storyline heading into the season. So. In your mind, what is? What do you think is the biggest or most intriguing storyline for the Bucks heading into this regular season?
I think it's kind of there's obviously many directions where you can go with it, and I'm kind of like splitting the season too, where it's like you have the regular season, you have the playoffs. I think just how does this team kind of go about replacing Brogdon? We obviously talked about this a lot already, but you know, you're already thin at point guard with just Eric Bledsoe and George Hill. You got, you know, Frank Mason's a two-way guy, but how much can you really lean on him throughout the year, and whether he sticks around the whole year too? But I just think that is going to make or break their season, really. And it's already kind of differing opinions already, you know, and now you just want to see the season start and see how these guys react to who's going to take the starting job, who's going to be able to kind of assert themselves, or maybe even kind of rise up in the Bucks core of players at this point. And maybe, you know, knock on wood, obviously, but what if injury strikes? How are they going to go, you know, about trying to fill in a missing piece in their backcourt? It just, there's so many different directions it can go in, and they're obviously banking on the players that they really believe in to kind of all together really provide what you're losing in Brogdon, but you just don't know until literally the ball tips off and we'll see.
Absolutely. All right. So let's lay out the best case, worst case scenario. Why don't we start with the worst case, and then we'll end with what I think will be a very, very positive and happy best case scenario. But let's start with the worst case.
Well, I think the worst case scenario would probably you don't play up to the same standard as you set for yourself last year. Obviously, the whole kind of big question, not just, you know, the Malcolm Brogdon storyline, but the whole big question that's hanging over the season is just Giannis's long-term future. And obviously, they go to the conference finals. Everything's kind of great. And, like, you just see, you know, substantial progress on that front. But sustaining that level of success, I mean, that if the Bucks fall anything short of, you know, not going to the conference finals, not making the NBA finals or whatever, that could have huge implications on whether Giannis stays in Milwaukee long term. So just kind of, there's going to be the pressure around this season is going to be immense.
They can't just keep signing his siblings.
No, they cannot. I mean, as hard as they might try with Kostas and or maybe Alex when he hits the league, but yeah, that's a big doozy, obviously.
Absolutely. All right. So give us the best case scenario. Best case scenario, when if everything works out the way that you think it does, what does this team look like come next April as we start to head into the playoffs?
I think it's basically, do they look as dangerous of a team as, you know, as they were heading into last year's playoffs? And obviously, best case scenario, you reach the NBA Finals, the other presumptive East contender, the Sixers, are obviously a dangerous threat in their own right. And I mean, if all goes according to plan and how it looks on paper, that could be the Eastern Conference Final matchup, and that could be a pretty tasty one too. But I just think it's, you know, if they look very similar, you don't lose any ground, or, you know, are pretty much a very cohesive and just kind of locked in team, as they are already looking so far. I guess it's preseason, but still, I think that's definitely best case scenario.
All right. So all that being said, give us your prediction about where you think their regular season record is going to end up. And then what do you think they're going to do in next year's playoffs? Where do they go? Do they win the title? Do they get to the finals? Do they get to the conference finals? Where do you see the regular season record, and where do you see them finishing in the playoffs?
60 wins is it's a hard one to top. They certainly can do it, you know, with Giannis on the team, is anything's possible, and obviously health permitting too. I do think they drop off a couple games. I would probably go 58-24, but I think that's still probably, I would say that's good for first in the East. And I do think they make it to the NBA Finals. That doesn't sound as confident as I wanted to be, but I think they're going to the finals.
You think they can win it?
I don't. Does
it depend on who? All right, let's ask the question this way. Let's say they make the finals. Which team in the West? And obviously, we haven't seen the regular season, so it's hard to really make too much of a prediction. And a lot of these teams are brand new. Mm-hmm. But which team would you, of the top contenders over there, which team would you most like to see them face that you think that they could beat based on matchups? And which team would you least like to see come at them if they were to meet somebody in the finals?
I think the team I don't want to face at all, I think, I mean, hands down, would probably be the Clippers. Just because you saw what Kawhi did to dismantle the Bucks last year, you don't want to see that again.
For sure. And
you have not that Paul George is a second banana, but I mean, you know, he was MVP finalist last year. Like that's a pretty big challenge. The other thing too, is I don't know. I know Lakers are getting a lot of title contending buzz and stuff like that, but like, I don't see it completely with them. I don't know. Maybe it's another team. Maybe the Rockets are a better team than kind of we give them credit for or something. I don't know, but I think for sure it's the Clippers. I would want no part of her if they meet in the finals.
Yeah, two guys. I mean, you figure what, as you said, that the fact that Kawhi already was able to sort of put the clamps on Giannis last year, and then you look at if Kawhi is getting a rest, and you can throw Paul George, who's been a perennial first-team All-NBA defensive player. Yeah. You know, when Kawhi rests, now Giannis has got to go against Paul George. That's not a fun group. They're going to be menacing on defense for sure. I mean, their lineup with Beverly and everybody that they can throw out there, They're going to be very, very difficult to score on. And so I think the Clippers, their key is going to be, just like every team, but their key is going to be what's their health like come next spring. And if they're healthy, they're going to be right there to knock on the door of getting to the finals and maybe winning it. But the Bucks are too. I think you laid it out that the Bucks and the Sixers are definitely the two favorites coming out of the East. And I would be very surprised at this point, unless there's some kind of injury or really surprise that occurs, that those two teams aren't going to be the two teams that meet in the final in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
All right. Well, Jordan, we appreciate you jumping on to talk Bucks tonight. It was fun to dive a little bit deeper into one of the presumptive Eastern Conference favorites. Thanks a lot, Jordan. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.